too long after lunch this afternoon. And hopefully, God willing, about the time you're all lying there sound asleep, around 11:30 or so tonight, if you get to bed that early. Well, we're supposed to be getting in up to Reno and driving on up to Lake Tahoe and sharing the rest of the Feast of Tabernacles for the last 2 days with the brethren up there at beautiful Lake Tahoe at Kings Beach. Unfortunately, we had tears in our eyes, and we were down a little bit when we had to leave 617 brethren down at Panama City Beach. Being there for those 2 days with those wonderful people was just like a little taste of the millennium, and when we had to leave after all those hugs and handshakes and tearful expressions of love and support, it was kind of sad. So then we get up there after this rather agonizing day. They managed in the airlines to take my Naugahyde suit bag and mangle it up in little shreds and give it to me and tear up the sleeve of one of my jackets and tear the corner off of my wife's suitcase so we could see her sweaters in there. But anyway, we got up to land between the lakes, and here was another 600 and some people, and that was absolutely fabulous. So all of a sudden, it's a feast again, and everybody is joyous, and more hugs and tears and handshakes. We just had an absolutely wonderful time. I got to tell you about one day up there, because if you talk about a full day, it's sort of like yesterday. I get up in the morning, and we go to breakfast pretty early, and there are about 8 of God's people, and we say, "Can we join you?" And we sat and visited with them, go to services, and I spoke to the people, and then we immediately went down and had a big barbecue. They had buffalo burgers and chili and another couple 150 people, and we met all kinds of people. One wonderful three-tour Vietnam Master Sergeant, retired Marine, and he was pretty gimpy in one leg, and I walked down the stairs slowly with him. Some other fantastic people, pilots, retirees, one man who had driven I don't know how many hundreds of miles on his Harley Davidson to be at the feast. And we enjoyed that barbecue with him that afternoon. Then we went out that evening with 15 of us, went to dinner, and then they took us that night to the Kentucky Opry, where about half of our people were. And the Baptist family that were all Western-style musicians were making a few left-handed jokes about this Garner Ted Armstrong. And the people really enjoyed that. They began to applaud. And he said, did he put all this together, or was that his daddy, Herbert? He said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "I had this clown, and he had a hat that was pushed up, you know, the way they do, and it's weird-looking red tie and a plaid shirt and all that." And he was a funny clown. And he said, the other guy asked him how his hat got that way. He said, "Well," he said, "he went to an Oral Roberts healing session." You know, be healed. That hat was turned up. So they had a little bit of fun at my expense, and I was telling my wife, "You know, one of these days, now that I'm going on 67, they're going to quit calling me the boy." But I don't know if they're going to do that or not. But we got really tired, so at the intermission we left, and then a bunch of people came up to me the next day and told me that he was looking for me and wanting me to get up there and join them and sing that night. So that would have really been a full day. But the next day, we had to leave right after services. And there again, lots of tears and letdown. We had to drive down to Nashville and then fly to, where'd we go? Dallas, and wait an hour and fly to Tulsa and drive down here and get in about 9:35 or so. And then get up the next morning. That was yesterday. So here we go. Anyway, I kind of dread it. It'd be so nice. And this is such a wonderful area, like a family area. Everybody stays together. And my son and daughter-in-law and a bunch of you other people, Stan and his wife and a bunch of others, are out there in a campground. So we stopped and saw where they were. They've got a whole tent community out there with strung up colored lights and a big outdoor fire. And the lake you can see down there, and they were fishing, and I think they caught some fish. Did you catch fish? Did you clean them? You ate them last night? You did? You didn't eat them? Oh, okay. Well, while we're standing there, sort of like a little foretaste of the millennium, they've been telling me about this beautiful buck with about 5 points on each side that have been going back and forth. And right while we're there for a special treat, he walked right across the road. And we said, "Look at that." And there were some other deer with him and everything. And, boy, it is like a little foretaste of the millennium. The two things wonderful about it. Number one is God's people. Everybody being here together. I guess number two is the lake and the weather and the environment. feeding little squirrels on our balcony and talking to Ann Lingle and Ben and Lois and sitting there yesterday and chatting. It's a wonder I can even talk. I've been talking nonstop for days here. So it is going to be sad for us to have to leave, and I wish we didn't. But Charlie Gross told me that he wanted me to go to all the peace sites, and the people wanted to listen to me a little while. I don't know why sometimes, but they wanted me to go to all the peace sites. So my old tired aching back and my wife helping me out, well, we'll do it. I don't know how much time you've had to look at the news. I know those of you in the campground certainly haven't been able to tune into television. Maybe in one way that's a great blessing, not to have to see what's going on out there in this rotten world. I have started dozens of my personal appearance campaigns over the last 18 and a half years by stating the last chapter in European history has not been written. And as a quick reminder, I think all of you know that for decades during the Cold War, we were talking about the coming reunification of Germany and the fact that the Eastern European countries would come out from behind the Iron Curtain. Little did I know at the time that I was saying all of that, that there was an underground movement which was finally revealed in a CIA report in which the Reagan administration was complicit with the Pope at Rome for keeping the Solidarity movement in Poland under Lech Walesa alive. But that happened with clandestine publications and communications in the basements and the little rooms of Catholic churches and cathedrals all over Poland. I did know innately that the election of a Polish pope would prove to be a crowbar which would pry loose Poland, East Germany eventually, and Bulgaria and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, which is now divided up in the velvet divorce between the Slovakian Republic, Czech Republic, and Slovakia, as you know, and all of the Eastern European countries that for so many years after World War II, for over 45 years, were under the brutal heel of Soviet domination and occupation. The fact that all of that changed when it did seemed to just go by the average American person almost as if it hadn't even happened. I rushed over to Berlin, as you know, with my son Mark and David, and we did some programs right there on Charlottenstrasse and right before the Brandenburg Gate and the Checkpoint Charlie, which is long since gone. We actually helped with the hammers there to knock a few pieces out of the wall, and I brought back a few chips, one of them about that large. I'm still on my desk, and I have it there with the painted graffiti, and not anything you can read, but just the colors of a piece of that concrete that divided the city of Berlin for all of those many, many years. But not only have I emphasized Europe and the rise of the United States of Europe, but the two most important prophecies I've always pointed to, and I do again this morning, are the prophecies of Christ found in Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21. Matthew 24, that talks about the abomination of desolation in verse 15, and Luke 21, 20, that says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, then know the destruction thereof is nigh. You could have awakened this morning and tuned in to CNN and have heard and seen the following announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you a special communique. We now go to our White House correspondent, Wolf Blitzer. Ladies and gentlemen, an all-out Scud attack has been launched against Israel using chemical and biological weapons. Early reports are there are over 370,000 dead. The Israeli Air Force is on its way to Syria, from whence they believe these silkworm missiles and Scuds have landed on Israel, and the United States is deeply involved. You could actually hear a report that a massive armed attack from Arabs surrounding Israel had been launched. Now, we live in a very real world, and all of you know about the blasting out of the front of the building down there in Saudi Arabia that took so many lives and injured hundreds, and about the sergeant I've talked about that was on the roof that saw the big tanker truck pull away and the people furtively get into an automobile and speed away, and how he ran down floor by floor from the top, banging on doors and saying, it's a bomb, get out, get out. Some people thought he was kidding. Other people took him seriously. Some of them fled. Some of them were saved. He was then knocked off his feet, knocked unconscious, but his life was saved in trying to save other people's lives. I immediately went and wrote an article called "The Bomb Blast in Saudi Arabia, Did It Shatter the Last Chances for World Peace?" By the time our small staff, absolutely overburdened and way behind my rather rapid churning out of articles, got to the point where we could begin to publish that, so many other things had happened, so many new things had occurred, I had to go back, change the title, rewrite portions of it, and it is the article coming out in the latest 20th Century Watch, which was printed last Thursday. I was hoping that a few copies would be sent as a package here to the feast so you could pick them up, but I hope they will all be waiting for you when you get home. And you will see an article that has to do with what is happening in the Middle East, and it's fairly current. As I speak, maybe they have arrived back, but Yasser Arafat, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Jordan's King Hussein are on their way returning to the Middle East. Yasser Arafat and Benjamin Netanyahu came here from perhaps 30 to 50 miles apart, traveled thousands of miles, go to the White House, have a photo op with Mr. Clinton, stand there, shook hands a couple of times, and wouldn't say a word. I watched this morning as yesterday President Clinton walked over to a microphone, picked up the microphone, walked over in front of Yasser Arafat. Did you see it? With a smile on his face. Yasser Arafat stood there and would not say a word. He wouldn't speak. Nothing was accomplished. They were here at the invitation of the Clinton administration. The Europeans were very miffed because the Europeans have a big stake in all of this in the Middle East. And, of course, Mubarak refused to come even though invited. And that is important. Let me give you why it's important. In the backdrop of the bomb blast in Saudi Arabia, a unique thing occurred that has not taken place since the 1950s. It went by the American populace just like it had not even happened. But Abdullah, who was a stand-in king for Sheikh Fahd of Saudi Arabia, went trotting up to Damascus to see Assad. And also going to Damascus in a tripartite emergency Arab summit was Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, who is proving to be quite a power broker. But you see, his predecessor, whom I knew personally in an interview, Anwar Sadat, had begun the Camp David Accords. Israel had given back the Sinai, Sharm el-Sheikh, all the way to the Suez Canal, making Egypt not only self-sufficient, but being able to export oil, which is probably one of the most generous and grandiose gestures of trading land for peace in the history of the Middle East, notwithstanding the demands by the Arab countries involving the Golan, the Gaza Strip, Hebron, the West Bank, the settlements, and, of course, an autonomous Palestinian state. And, of course, the Camp David Accords have been in place ever since the time of the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And Hosni Mubarak has an understanding, a peace treaty, if you will, with Israel, as does King Hussein of Jordan. Hussein can't help it. He's sandwiched between Iraq and Israel, and his little country, including Aqaba, would be out like that if the Israeli army decided to take it out. But so the only one who shows up for sort of a showcase appearance is King Hussein. Nothing was accomplished. Nothing was agreed upon. There was no real agenda. They came here. They shook hands. They were photographed, and they're on their way home. While they were here, demonstrations were breaking out again. Not major like before, but there was stone throwing. And yesterday, during the summit, the Israeli soldiers shot to death another Palestinian involved in the riots. And there have been other sporadic upsets in Gaza and Hebron, and they are happening while we sit here, because it's much, much later over there this afternoon. It's probably getting close to sunset in the Middle East. Who knows what tomorrow will bring. Why are these things important? We're talking here about Jerusalem. We're talking about the fact that just before the feast began, I was treated to the view of armed Israeli soldiers and Palestinians on the Temple Mount with gun bursts going off, because they opened a some 2,000-year-old tunnel that allegedly goes very close to the bedrock upon which the Al-Aqsa Mosque stands. And some of the young Palestinians, 90-some percent of them weren't even born when I was first in Israel in 1966, just before that war in 67. They weren't even born yet. But their parents have successfully poisoned the minds of each succeeding generation of young Islamic fundamentalists, so that they hate the Jews. And if anybody thinks Yasser Arafat is controlling Black September and Abu Nidal's group and the Islamic fundamentalist group that is responsible for all of this, like Islamic Jihad and Hamas, he does not control all those people. He has elements within his own Palestinian groups who would like to assassinate him. So the man has to travel very carefully with a heavy bodyguard and be very conscious of security all the time. He is not really a leader of the Palestinian Arabs in his own right. He would like to be. And he's got to be one of the most thwarted and frustrated men in the world. I don't know, because I didn't see it. People have told me since I've been here at the feast that I should have caught Larry King live, who interviewed a man who wrote a book about how the Pope could become an arbiter or a mediator for Middle East peace. Did anybody else happen to see that? Anybody see that? Good for you. I'd like to hear a little more about it. But that's astonishing. You all know what we've been expecting and what we've been writing about in other issues of 20th Century Watch, that there actually has been an exchange of letters between the Israeli foreign minister and one of the Vatican deputies with regard to an offer that the Pope could set up a kind of a second Vatican in the old city, so that instead of trying to make it into a political capital for one of the political elements — the Jews, of course, have it now as their capital, the Palestinians are demanding that it become their capital of a separate autonomous Palestinian state — instead of that, they would like to make it, as Pope Paul John has called it, a corpus separatum, or an internationalized city that is accessible to all of the faiths of the three monotheistic religions, and take it out of the political arena so they won't fight over it anymore. If the Pope goes to Jerusalem, does that ring a bell in anybody's mind about what we've thought and wondered would occur and would happen in the Middle East? It makes me wonder about millions of Americans who, back decades ago, probably around 30 million a week, were listening to my voice. Over 360 radio stations and 165 television channels, including Washington, D.C., where many members of Congress and past presidents told me face-to-face that they watched the program all the time, including LBJ and Hubert Humphrey and Cyrus Vance and so many other people, some of them long dead. But those people received a witness. I'm amazed now at how many preachers there are. And there are televangelists who are talking about Europe may become the beast, and are talking about prophecy and talking about the Middle East. And there are others who are looking for the Pope being involved in Palestine. But just like when I was a boy in 1946 and the Feast of Tabernacles was only kept by my parents and a little small group in Eugene, Oregon, and now there are Feasts of Tabernacles all over this world, down there and through there and over there and out yonder. And there are tens of thousands of people all over the world observing the Feast of Tabernacles in different groups, yes, but observing the Feast of Tabernacles. And so far as I know, and I'm sincere about this, it began with my father and my mother in our own home at 1608 West 6th Street in Eugene, Oregon, when I was a young teenager. And it's grown from that. I'm going to propose, and I think it's true, that from the 50s all through the 60s and 70s, the Plain Truth, the Good News, and Tomorrow's World magazines — at one time we had three full-color magazines going out to a huge mailing list. One time I think the Plain Truth reached somewhere around 5 million circulation. I believe that there are lots of people out there who, when these great events begin to happen, they're going to say, wait a minute, I remember hearing something about this. I really think that that may happen, and I think some people may begin to wake up. Well, when those three — and that was a signal that was sent to a lot of intelligence agencies that began to worry about it, and you can believe, as I can believe, that while we are sitting here, the whisper of all sorts of encrypted communications is flowing back and forth between Israeli intelligence and Egyptian and Syrian and Saudi Arabian intelligence and the United States intelligence agencies, and that the CIA is on top of it, and that the satellite photographs are coming down and being analyzed on the hour in the Pentagon while we're here. Because any massive troop movement of Syrians toward Quneitra and toward the Golan Heights, any movements of Iraqi armed forces, any movements of Egyptian armed forces, anything unusual going on, all these intelligence agencies would want to know about it immediately. So be aware of the real world in which we live, and be aware that your Savior and mine, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, talked about Jerusalem. What has been in our news during the feast, just before the feast? Jerusalem. What's the fight all about? Jerusalem. the holy places, the Temple Mount. When our Savior tells us, when you see the abomination stand in the holy place, verse 14, chapter 13 of Mark, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing where it ought not, let him that reads understand, just like Matthew 24, 15, almost an identical verse, let them that be in Judea flee to the mountains. And then he says, do it instantly. Don't even go to take anything out of your house if you're on the housetop. If you're in the field, don't even go back to get a garment. Woe to them that are pregnant women and those that are nursing in those days. Pray that your flight be not in the winter, for in those days there shall be affliction such as was not from the beginning of the creation which God created unto this time. Worse than World War I, worse than World War II, where estimates soar as high as 70 million deaths. Worse than all of the other wars put together. And except the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh should be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he hath chosen, he has shortened the days. We have talked about no flesh be saved. Back just after the Gulf War, I began hearing some rather clandestine reports. They certainly weren't making the mainstream media, that something like 70,000 United States soldiers had been exposed to low-grade chemical and or, they didn't know, biological poisoning, and that there were several different veterans groups that were beginning to lobby the Pentagon and the armed forces in order to get compensation because they were coming up with strange diseases, all sorts of things from bleeding ulcers. A couple of them are named in the articles you're going to get from some of the national weekly news sources. Leukemia, cancerous-like symptoms, rashes, all sorts of things that are happening. Now they're beginning to admit it. But of course, there's money involved. There are gigantic lawsuits involved. But there are a number of veterans organizations that have gotten together to try to seek justice because some of them even have speculated. And we saw them in their suits and their uncomfortable suits. And are you hot in there? Remember during Desert Storm and the guys that looked like men from Mars in a big rubber anti-gas, anti-sarin gas suits and so on? But because money is involved and huge lawsuits would be involved and the government would have to settle with thousands and thousands of these families, they're pretty cagey about all that. But some of them actually begun to charge that perhaps Americans were put out there almost like guinea pigs. And that they were sort of deliberately being exposed to some of these things to find out what happens. Well, there happened to have been biological and chemical warheads fitted to artillery shells and to aerial dumb bombs, not the smart bombs, that were in forward ammunition dumps down near Kuwait or in Kuwait during Desert Storm. American bombs and or artillery shells exploded such an ammunition dump. The huge cloud that went up into the air drifted back over U.S. troops, and many of them, their wives, their families, deeply involved, because here they are, young men and or maybe some women, afflicted with who knows what kinds of symptoms as a result of exposure to all of that. It's finally being admitted that something like that did occur. Why is the Middle East important? I think all of you know, but these are exact statistics. These are exact. And I won't say a lot about this because I've written about it, and you're aware. Japan, 70% dependent. That vibrant supergiant, that powerful economy, the world's greatest shipbuilder, the world's greatest creditor nation, the world's greatest... Well, the United States, they own our mortgage. They buy up our debt. If the Japanese didn't show up at the discount window, we would be absolutely bankrupt, and the great big inflated balloon that is the global economy would collapse tomorrow, and they have the power to absolutely destroy the United States economically and to reduce us down to a position of Bangladesh. The Japanese are 70% dependent upon Middle Eastern oil, and just about the bulk of it flows through the Straits of Hormuz, and out of the Persian Gulf sheikdoms. Of course, a lot of the Iranian oil and the Iraqi oil especially is not necessarily obtainable, but about 80% of the reserves are under Saudi Arabian sands, and that's where it all flows, in those huge big super tankers that flow through there. You all know that they were threatening way back when to blow up a super tanker and sink it in the throat of the narrow Straits of Hormuz, which would actually block all of that shipping, and what that would mean to the Japanese. Europe is 46% dependent upon Middle Eastern oil. The United States, 17%. Doesn't sound like much. But on the other hand, we get a lot of oil from Nigeria, Venezuela, from Mexico especially, but and some domestic production, but for 17% is significant that we depend upon the Middle East. Now, even as I've said on television, if we didn't know the identity of Israel, if we didn't know that Britain, Northwestern Europe, and the United States were part of the lost 10 tribes of Israel, and I do know that, and I do believe it, it doesn't matter about our involvement. Who is involved? Who was involved? Where did the summit take place? Who was there? Why were they there? Why is the whole world, with all of its cameras from Japan and all of Europe and everywhere else, taking pictures in the White House the other day in Washington? Because of fights going on in the streets of Jerusalem and Hebron, the Gaza Strip, because of Palestine. And for all these decades, I've continued to say, watch the Middle East, watch Jerusalem. Why? Why watch? Well, Jesus Christ tells us in the 13th chapter of Mark, Jesus began to predict his second coming. If you will look in verse 24, in those days after that tribulation, the tribulation has got to occur, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light. And you know that that's explained in the 6th chapter of Revelation, in the 7th chapter. And the 7th chapter of Revelation means to me that that latent awareness out there, all over the world really, in Europe and many other countries, but certainly where we have saturated Canada and Australia and the United States with the message of witness and warning for so many years, that people are going to repent when they literally see the heavenly signs. It won't be a matter of some news communique that they can kind of flip over and say, well, I'd rather watch baseball. Not anymore. Not when it's happening right up there. Not when it's happening out of doors. Not when it's absolutely up close right in your face. And when the heavenly signs are there, with all these other things going on at the same time, with a global economic bubble having been burst a lot earlier, and with all these other things happening in society that you almost hate to enumerate, they are going to notice. The stars of heaven shall fall like a meteorite shower, the powers that are in heaven shall be shaken, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And then shall he send his angels, and shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven. Let me share something with you. It's a little puzzle to me. I don't claim that I've got it figured out. Maybe it's a happy statement. Maybe it is a sad one. I like to try to envision the time when that will happen. Where will we be? Will my wife and I still be down near Lake Palestine in Tyler? Where will we be? What will it feel like? Will we be taken through the roof? Will it be a spiritual transporting? Will we be out of doors? How will we be caught up? I know we talk about people and their idea of the rapture, but this scripture says that he shall send his angels and they shall gather his elect, God's people, converted people, from all over the world, and that Christ is descending and that we shall meet the Lord in the air, 1 Thessalonians 4:17, and in that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. Now imagine yourself being transported, being, as it were, caught up. I don't know if you feel an angel under your shoulders. I don't think so, because I think at that time it says the resurrection is going to occur. We shall not precede those that sleep. The dead in Christ shall rise first. And we which are alive and remain, 1 Corinthians 15:50-52, shall be caught up together with them in the air. And so we shall ever be with the Lord, because he's standing on the Mount of Olives, and the millennium is going to begin very shortly after the completion of the second 3.5-year part of Christ's ministry. All right? Try to imagine with me being caught up in the air. Maybe my wife and I will look and we will become aware as we get nearer. What do we have then? Do we have Superman vision? Do we have powerful vision? 10 power, 20 power vision, or vision like I've got? I don't know the answer to that. But I've always thought, I'll see. Well, there's my dad. And there's my mom. Hi, Mom, it's Mom. Cheryl, look. And my brother Dick, and her brother Dick. And her sister Norma, and her father, Papa. But there also are a lot of other people. Oh, look, honey, it's Al and Gerald and Ron. Hi, Ron. Hi, Allie. Hi, everybody. There you are. Hi, Jim and John and Tom and all of you. Look, honey, they're all here. We are all together. We're all together now. And we're going to land on the Mount of Olives. And here is the Lord Jesus Christ. And here are millions of angels. And here are all these people that we know. And that we have known for 30 years, 40 years of our lives. Today, never the twain shall meet. Today, a broad gap like the Grand Canyon that cannot be bridged somehow stand between us. Not between me and them, but between some of them and me, I guess, or us, I should say. And I mean to put it that way. But I know that we're going to be together. I have to believe that. And I have to believe that many others are going to be there. Don't tell me I've got all the answers. I am absolutely not in possession of all the answers. I don't have perfect understanding of how God is going to work out and sort through all of these things, some of which are puzzles to me. But Jesus Christ promises. And the great thing that he promises to me has two parts. Not only to be saved spiritually and to be caught up, whether I'm alive or dead, together with those who have been long dead or those who have died recently, like the lady over in Springfield whose funeral is going to be graced by these lovely flowers. Whether my father and mother and my grandparents before them and your loved ones too, or whether those who are alive and remain through the tribulation. So to me, one of the most precious promises are the promises that Jesus continues to give us. He says, learn the parable of the fig tree. When a branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So in like manner, when you shall see these things come to pass, know that it is nigh, even at the doors. Now he said to those who lived there that that generation would not pass, and it didn't, because of that incredible destruction in 71 A.D., where over 200,000 Jews were impaled by bituminous pitch smeared on their bodies, and their bodies set alight, according to Josephus, while they yet lived, and it lit up the streets of Jerusalem, one of the most mass tortures in the history of the world, another pogrom, an annihilation. And according to history, the high priest heard an audible voice to get out of there, and those that listened to him and fled to Pella escaped. They, like a microcosm of what is to occur in the future, heard the representative of God, the high priest, who claimed an audible voice had spoken to him in the temple, get out. But Jesus warned that living generation. And those who didn't listen remained in the streets of Jerusalem and suffered that incredible, horrible fate. He goes on to say, verse 32, of that day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven. So much for all the charts and graphs and tapes and letters and literature that are sent to me where they got it figured out. Neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch, and pray. For you know not when the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Everybody had their job, but there was also those who had to watch. Watch you therefore, for you know not when the master of the house cometh, at evening, or at midnight, when you be sound asleep, or at cock-crowing in the early pre-dawn morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And of course he means spiritual sleep, being unaware, unalert, uninvolved, and not watching. He said, and what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Now in Luke 21, he goes a little further in Luke's account, and he adds some very important words. He says, beginning in verse 28, and when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. Now, what makes me look down and what makes me feel down is daily television, my news reports, 6-year-old boy being sued for sexual harassment because he kissed a little girlfriend in the first grade. All of the things that I have talked about and taken issue with for all of these so many, many years. How long would it take us to recount them all? If we were all the same race, if there was no racism, if we were all of the same religion, if there was no religious prejudice, if we all spoke the same language, and we don't globally in this world. There are hundreds and hundreds of languages, from Kurdish and Urdu and Japanese and German and white, enumerate very many of them. If we had no other problem except the population explosion, if we had no other problem except the food versus population curve, the diminution of the world grain supply, I could go on and on and on about that, then this world would be absolutely headed for a doomsday moment when food wars, wars over water, wars over the diminishing means of survival would be fought by massive segments of populations all over the world. Shall I talk about pestilence, about drought, about the Ebola virus, about other strange chronic diseases, about the fact that many of us in this room have terrible debilities and diseases, and I too have a chronic bronchial condition that's been with me for about 6 years, of people that have diseases that they absolutely cannot get rid of all the articles I've read about the superbugs that resist every kind of spray, herbicide, and bactericide that man has ever been able to invent? Shall I talk about the fact that antibiotics that they will feed you of all different types, steroids and every other family of antibiotics, cannot even knock some of the chronic diseases that people have got anymore? The flus that sweep the world regularly in the winter, the so-called, you know, the various Hong Kong and Chinese and every type of flu that you can imagine that take literally hundreds of thousands of lives. What about drought? And this last summer and right now, Falcon Lake down 47 feet. And what about drought? Do we remember Somalia and Mogadishu? Do you remember Chad? Do we remember what happened in Rwanda and the refugees fleeing and the pictures taken of them over in Zaire that looked like a picture out of Dante's hell of just a sea of black people standing in absolute rags with little distended bellies and little children with little legs like sticks in the last stages of starvation in their hundreds of thousands of one or two white faces of UN volunteer workers who were there with big American C-130s and others bringing in grain of the people absolutely rioting to get their hands on it? Is it real? Did it happen? Was it there? Did I see it in the cameras? Is it there today? Is it happening? Is that the way the world is? Shall I talk about the fact that bees are being afflicted with a tiny little mite that is killing the honeybees, and that the orchards, the fruits and vegetables of everywhere from the beautiful valleys over where Ben and Lois live in Utah to the Central Valley of California are being heavily afflicted because they're trucking the bees over there and there are not enough of them to go around to even pollinate the crops for foodstuffs? Shall I talk about the member of our church, the young farmer down in the southeast who sent me a farm publication just the other day that I still have on my desk and have yet to quote and incorporate in a new booklet, where he talked about world grain reserves, United States grain reserves, and the fact that we're not going to have another green revolution the way we had before the Vietnam War, which quadrupled the yield per acre, that it's not going to happen again, and that it's not a matter of sheer economics of some farmers rejoicing because the market and the demand is there so they make more money. It's a matter of how much grain can be produced. I'll give that to you later, but that's one of ours who is also watching. And he saw that in a local farming publication, clipped it out and sent it to me, and it just raised my hair. I said, wow, I didn't know it was that bad. Shall I talk about nuclear proliferation, nuclear detonating devices, and high-grade plutonium being caught on the black market by European, mostly German, businessmen trying to smuggle the stuff to Iran? Is it real? Did I read it? Has it happened? Were the arrests made? Were those checks caught in that one Volvo with all of that high-grade plutonium in their trunk or not? Shall I talk about chemical and biological weapons? Shall I talk about the decaying infrastructure of the United States? Shall I talk about the destruction of the American family? Shall I talk about 30% of our population who believe in same-sex marriages? Shall I talk about the gay rights movement? Not Adam and Eve, but Adam and Steve. Shall I talk about the Americans all over this country whose children are being subjected in the first grade and even preschool to literature by homosexuals that are actually encouraging them not to worry if mommy is brought up, if their mommy has, you know, two mommies, or if they have two daddies, children being engendered by homosexuals and then taken home to live with two parents of the same sex? Shall I talk about that or just let it go? And what about the book? Where are you, Dennis? The book that Dennis is going to send by Judge Bork. Slouching Toward Sodom. Isn't that the name of it?
Gomorrah.
Toward Gomorrah. Slouching Toward Gomorrah. I don't have room to take it with me, but Mr. DeJarnett is going to send it to me. Maybe my son Matthew can bring it down. About a $25 big, thick, hard book. And apparently it is really a stunning book. Oh, there it is, honey. You've got it. Yeah, Slouching Toward Gomorrah. Judge Bork. And it's probably going to be depressing. I'll try not to let it depress me. But, I mean, he is going to set forth the facts of where we are as a society. Is it true, the drive-by shootings? Is it true, the gang warfare? Is it true when people get lost and go down a cul-de-sac in Los Angeles, merely turn around because they don't know where they are, get shot down by gangsters in the street, young kids that have guns? Is that true? Was it true the other day during the feast when I saw the 40,000 shoes in the Washington, D.C. mall? Empty shoes. Every one of them had been worn until about a year ago by a young person in our beloved country. The mother that held the shoes and was interviewed and said, I wouldn't take $1 million for these shoes. And for his son, for her son that had stood in them. 40,000 shoes, every one of them representative of a youth who had been shot down by a gun in our country. Shall I talk about increased illegitimacy? Shall I talk about what is happening not only among all the minorities, but increasingly in the majority of our society today, of little children, more than one-third of them in the United States, who are born out of wedlock, about children having children, 13, 14, 15, burdened with babies they don't want. Shall I talk about crime, about drugs? Shall I talk about the corrupt criminal justice system? Shall I talk about the breakdown of the legal system? Shall I talk about education? What shall I talk about? Let me give you this scripture, and then I want to go back to the book of Isaiah. Verse 36, this is the good part, because there are two kinds of salvation that Christ offers. Watch you, therefore, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things. Now, it's one thing not to escape them. He says, take no thought what you shall say in the day that you shall be delivered. The time will come when they that kill you will think they do God a service. He said that to his disciples, and it came true to Peter. It came true to James, the brother of John, who was beheaded with a sword. It came true to Polycarp. It came true to many righteous, good, decent men who believed God's truth and who were butchered and put to death in horrible ways back during that time. And it will come true once again. But this is something worthy, it seems to me, of notice. Because if I could have them all here, I have one of my grandchildren here today. That if I could have the other three, my little grandson, Michael, who is 9, and my precious little granddaughter, little Sonia D., who is 4, and her little brother, because his mother is a Yugoslavian girl. I don't know exactly what the little name Pichu in Yugoslav means. It means cute little kid, I guess. But if I could have all of them here, and my little granddaughter, I would say this is what makes it worthwhile to try to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. I don't know why that as a human being, and God knows this about me, so maybe it is an imperfection and I can acknowledge that it is, but wanting to escape all these things is something that really comes down to home and in my mind and heart, and I can really understand. Martyrdom and being caught up in the air and meeting Christ as he comes back, that's difficult to understand. I can pray about it. I can believe it. I do understand, I think, and believe that it's true because Christ says it is true. But experiencing it and the reality of it is a little different for me than the immediacy of armed gangs coming down the street and us hearing it looking out the window, oh, honey, look. And here they come with rifles and clubs and knives and everything to assault us in our home. I mean, now that's something that is more immediate and up close for me that I can really get hold of and understand. Because it has happened in other societies and it's going to happen in ours. He says, Watch you therefore and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things. And that's the things of the tribulation that I've been enumerating. That shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Let's go back to the book of Isaiah. And here is a beautiful chapter in the book of Isaiah. Back into the 60th to the 64th, actually beginning clear back at the 59, is a whole area that we all ought to refresh our memories. But in chapter 62, he actually is taking Zion or Jerusalem, and that depicts God's people. And there's some very interesting verses here. For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace. Now remember, Jesus Christ said the time is going to come, there won't be one stone left atop another in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. We have asked time and again, what would trigger the building of a temple? Well, certainly the dynamiting and the bulldozing out of the way of those Arab mosques would do it. Is it going to come about just through attrition? Are there going to be more and more uprisings, then stronger and stronger Israeli response? Will the Israelis take those tanks and rumble right into the Gaza Strip and reoccupy it? Will they try to disarm those 30,000 Palestinians into whose hands they've given automatic weapons? I don't know. Or will it be something even more? The destruction of those mosques. That would bring in Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and all of them. And then a massive, major war would erupt in the Middle East. Well, after the time when all this is to occur, look at the picture. For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness. What has God called Jerusalem today? Does anybody know that? It's in the Bible. It's in the book of Revelation. The name for Jerusalem today is Sodom and Egypt, isn't it? It's in Revelation 11, in the prophecy about the two witnesses. God doesn't call Jerusalem right this minute the holy city. I mean, I can sing the beautiful song, The Holy City, and people can talk about the holy city, and American evangelists, and I guess I'm guilty because I've done it too, can run over there and make programs of the Dome of the Rock in the background, the world's most famous skyline. But that's not the holy city. That's Sodom and Egypt, is what God says. It's repugnant in His sight today. Until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, that's not today, that's not the Jewish nation of Israel, that's at no time in the past. No time in any government of Israel in the past could that have been applied. It's future. And the salvation thereof as a lamp that burns, as a bright light. And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness. Japan, Asia, Bangladesh, and India. And all kings thy glory. Talking about the Savior. And you shall be called by a new name, New Jerusalem, if that's the way we're to pronounce it, which the mouth of the Eternal shall name. You shall also be a crown of glory in the hand of the Eternal, and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. Thou shalt no more be termed forsaken, neither shall thy land any more be termed desolate. It's not termed that way today. It is not forsaken. It is not desolate. It is a cultural shock to come across the Allenby Bridge, up the hills, and finally to Jerusalem, and to devolve down onto the maritime plain, and to see all those millions of trees that have been planted, and the orchards, and the golden fields, and the green crops. The cultural shock between Jordan and Israel is palpable. I know because many of you have been there and you've experienced that, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. You shall no more be termed forsaken, neither shall your land any more be termed desolate, but you shall be called Hephzibah, and thy land Beulah, terms that mean joy and beauty and abundance. For the Eternal delighteth in thee, and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a virgin, a beautiful and a wondrous sight, so shall your sons marry thee. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, just like Christ is the bridegroom and the church is the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day nor night. You that make mention of the Eternal, keep not silence. Don't let your voice be stopped. Don't let the work cease. Keep on preaching, teaching, warning, writing, publishing, witnessing. Tell them about it. and give him no rest till he establisheth, until he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. The Eternal has sworn by his right hand and by the arm of his strength, saying, surely I will no more give thy corn to be meat for thine enemies. I think of the offloading of those huge chutes into those gigantic grain carriers and the golden corn pouring out and going overseas. And the fact that the United States is trying to feed all the rest of the world, of course, this is more than that. This is occupying armies actually just pillaging the land. And the sons of the stranger shall not drink thy wine for that which you have labored. But they that have gathered it shall eat it and praise the Eternal. And they that have brought it together shall drink it in the courts of my holiness. Go through the gates, prepare ye the way of the people. Cast up the highway, gather out the stones, because it's all lying there in rubble. Lift up a standard for the people. Behold, the Eternal is proclaimed upon the end of the world. Say ye to the daughter of Zion, behold, your salvation cometh. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. And they shall call him the holy people, call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Eternal, and you shall be called sought out, a city not forsaken. The major prophecies of Jesus Christ involve Jerusalem. It has nothing to do with cycles, with chronology, with some strange, obscure prophecy back in Malachi. It was something to do with Joshua and his filthy garments. It has nothing to do with trying to find your name or mine or some other preacher's name in the Bible. It has nothing to do with any of that. The one major place Jesus said to watch is Jerusalem. Now, it gets me into alert gear when I come to go and to be with God's people at the Feast of Tabernacles, and terrible riots and bloodshed and shooting of automatic weapons all over the streets of Hebron and the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem at the Temple Mount break out and are in the news. I think about 70-some killed and injured, last count that I've heard. And happening again, apparently, as we slept last night, and who knows, maybe right now, today. And it brings it home, because I know that something is going to bring about the building of a temple. And when the abomination of desolation stands in the holy place, and there is no holy place there yet, you've all heard the name Gershon Salomon, and he is the head of the temple of the faithful, of the Temple Mount. And we interviewed him on our television program, and he was interviewed again just the other day by some of the major networks. And of course, he wants to build a temple. I held up and showed you a beautiful desktop book that's probably about $175 a copy that was sent to me by the rabbi who has started a foundation. He's a heavily black-bearded man who was one of the first Israeli soldiers on the Temple Mount in the Six-Day War in 1967. And he has started a foundation, and it involves the red heifer. We were talking about that somewhere down in, I think, Alabama. But they're actually getting a herd ready. It showed the brazen pots and the vessels and all the various things that are the accoutrements of a temple. It showed the Urim and the Thummim, the breastplate, and the vestments of the priests. And these people are serious. It's a fundraising book. They want to build a temple, and they've sent it out to worldwide Jewry. It is a United States group, and they're trying to raise funds among American Jews. But remember that in the recent elections, the right-wing Jewish religious element gained some additional seats in the Knesset. And remember, too, that there have been a tremendous number of Soviet Jews who have come in, and they were the very ones for whom the government was making the settlements. And when Peres began to close down the settlements and actually have some of them abandoned when they were starting work on them, those Russian Jews represent a very powerful voting bloc. They wanted the settlements reopened. Netanyahu didn't dare put Ariel Sharon in. That would have absolutely triggered a war right then because of what they accused him of in the massacre of the refugee camps up in southern Lebanon several years ago. So instead, he made him a minister without portfolio with some obscure name, which still makes him loom very large in the government. And now Netanyahu, with a narrow coalition victory, with a narrow margin of victory, with four major portions of his platform, you'll read about in that article. It has to do with no Palestinian autonomy. Jerusalem will never again be a divided city, but remain the capital of Israel. They will not abandon Hebron because of the Jews that live there, and they won't put the Golan Heights on the table. They won't trade land for peace. Yet every one of those things were on the table and being negotiated by Peres. So for the first time that I know of in modern history, Germany gets into the act, and Germany issues a communique to Israel and says, you need to to continue the peace process started by your predecessor. That's like telling the current Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to abandon every plank of his platform that swept him into office and go back to the policies of his predecessor, who was assassinated and whom he replaced. Our own government got into that act. Europe did. All the Arabs did. The emergency summit that I talked about up in Damascus resulted in the huge Arab summit. You all saw it. You watched it. Clinton went there. Gaddafi rubbed it in the face of everybody and defied them and flew over there when he wasn't supposed to. But they said that Assad actually had the communique issued of calling for all these UN resolutions and putting all these things back on the table and getting the peace process back on track, and that it virtually was issued by all the other Arab states unchanged, and that Assad of Syria is the guy who authored the communique. And the United States has lined up behind it. Now, what I heard this morning when I got up, and I was really anxious to see, well, will they sandwich anything at all in here and all this other stuff about O.J. Simpson? It's driving me crazy. I can't stand to listen anymore about O.J. Simpson. But I wanted to hear about what was happening in Jerusalem. Sure enough, it came on, and they said, if more riots break out, it's 1 month from elections, they said it's going to be bad news for Mr. Clinton. Now, isn't that amazing the way the world works? That because Mr. Clinton has thrown his hat into the ring and basically is kind of chiding the Jews a little bit and kind of, you know, promoting Yasser Arafat and is kind of trying to play like he's involved, you know, like he has a powerful foreign policy and like he is a kind of a kingmaker and he has something to do with what's going on over there. And the Europeans aren't there, and Hosni Mubarak is not there, and the Saudis aren't involved, and the Syrians aren't involved, and Japanese are not involved, Mr. Clinton is. Anyway, they have said that that could cost him the election. Isn't it a strange world in which we live? Bob Dole's waiting in the wings, hoping they riot. Clinton's standing there and telling his wife at night, I sure hope they don't riot. You know, but that's what they said on the news this morning. I mean, brethren, what I'm trying to communicate to you is that we live in a very real world. When my wife and I leave this idyllic site here, these beautiful, peaceful grounds with the deer and the squirrels and everything, and this gorgeous lake, we're going to go to Tulsa. We're going to get in the midst of all these, you know, honking automobiles running around and the freeways, and big old aircraft going and coming, and millions of people flying every day. We're going to be back in the world for a little bit, and we don't want to be, until we get up there to Lake Tahoe and we can be with some of God's people again. But meanwhile, the old world is rolling right now as we're on it, and it's already nighttime in Israel. They've experienced another day over there, and maybe somebody else or several people have died, I don't know. But it comes home to me in its absolute shocking reality. When I look back, the Berlin Wall is gone, Germany is reunified, Eastern Europe came out from behind the Iron Curtain. It's called a United States of Europe. Europe unitedly is beginning to act. They have the EQ in place. They have the European Parliament. Europe is not completely integrated politically, but they are trying to head in that direction. And they certainly have a stake in the Middle East. All of mankind does, because we all know that Israel is nuclear armed. And now we know that that was sarin gas that American troops were exposed to. And we know that Saddam Hussein had given the orders to launch those warheads against Israel, and his forward battlefield commanders in charge of the Scuds disobeyed his orders. We don't know what happened to them, but we thought they were not conventional warheads. I leapt to my feet that night. My son, some of our family were at our home, and I said, that's it. When I saw those fiery missiles landing that night on Tel Aviv neighborhoods, I said, the Israeli Air Force is airborne. They've got nuclear weapons aboard, and they're on their way to Baghdad. And they were. But that red phone, George Bush was frantic. He got on that telephone time and time again. They rushed those Patriot batteries over there. They prevented the Israelis from turning Baghdad into glass. That could have been if hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, it wouldn't take many, Israelis had died. More than did die, one lady who, you know, suffocated putting on her gas mask, you heard about it. If that had happened, There would have been a giant war, and if you think the Israelis wouldn't have reacted with a vengeance to dynamite those mosques and to experience some kind of a national calling out to God and build a temple and go back to sacrifices, what did they do historically every time Israel got in terrible trouble? Under the days of like King Manasseh, under the days of Josiah's reform, they found the book of the law, they dusted it off, they read it, and they began to purify, and they appointed the priests, and they began to sacrifice, and they started the daily burnt offering again. And they said, we need to get back to God. Is that going to happen in our time? Let's turn to the book of Daniel, the 12th chapter. This means what it says to me, and I'm sure it does to all of us here today. Reading down from the 11th chapter, I won't do that. You're familiar with it, the king of the north and the king of the south. I don't know who the king of the south is yet. At that time, verse 12, chapter 1, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. So this is projecting forward to the resurrection and the time of the second coming of Christ, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. Remember the transfiguration that we talked about yesterday. And they that turn many to righteousness, involved in God's work, involved in new people, people from out there in the public. There are millions of them. 15,000 of them have asked for literature and tapes this year from our programs out there. A wonderful big number of people, that I wish it were 150,000. I wish it were 1,500,000 who are receiving our tapes and literature, who could hear what we have to say and what we have to give them. They that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the word, seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So Daniel looked, and behold, there stood other two, one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, priestly garments, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, these are like great angels or archangels that he saw in vision, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and an half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but understood not. And I said, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? He said, go on, Daniel. The words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. When you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, when the abomination stands in the holy place where it ought not, then know the, what? Destruction of Jerusalem is nigh. The literal time of the treading down of Jerusalem by Gentile forces is how long? 3.5 years. How long is Israel in captivity? 3.5 years. What is the length of time of the ministry of the two witnesses after all other organized preaching of the gospel is over? 3.5 years. How long shall it be to the end of these things? 3.5 years. The only thing we don't know is, when does the 3.5 years begin? But we know what's going to happen when it's over. Not to the day and the hour, but generally we know. Now, having gone over these things with you, as I have today, I'm not spooky about the year 2000, nor 2003, nor 2004. But as I look at all these things that I've talked about, and I look at our world news, I look at our domestic situation, all of them that I've talked about, I've listed them just about all today, I know that we are living in the time of the end. And we're tempted to think, because back in the 50s and 60s, we thought that it was very, very close, that maybe really it's further away today than it was then. Oh, no. No, it is much, much, much closer. There are far more nations with nuclear weapons today than then. And we didn't hear of American soldiers, 70,000 of them, suffering the effects of low-grade exposure to sarin gas. And we didn't hear of Japanese fanatics sending a couple of delegates over into Central Africa to take back a culture of the Ebola virus. We didn't hear about that back. We'd never heard of the Ebola virus back in those days. We'd never heard of AIDS back in those days, had we? How long can all of this continue in any sense of equilibrium until all these things begin to happen? Now, to me, I know because I remember from the days that I was a boy, the way my mom and dad always talked about the work. And I know that Dad was wrong during World War II, but you can't blame him, because of the days in which we lived then, with Europe occupied and with Britain under attack and with German armies headed toward Alexandria, the guns explosions were within sight and sound of Alexandria and headed toward the Suez Canal. And with the Japanese already having bombed Rangoon and Calcutta and looking over the roof of the world toward India, and with everywhere defeat after defeat after defeat. And he thought that the beast was in Central Europe, and he thought that Pope Pius XII was the one who was going to go to the Vatican. He thought at that time World War II was underway and we were in it, that was the Great Tribulation. It was not until the war began to go the other way, he said, no, well then this isn't the last one. There's got to come another great world war. Germany will rise out of the ashes of defeat. Germany will rise again and become the greatest power in Europe. And he said it even when Sir Winston Churchill said Germany would not rise for another 50 years. Well, it didn't take that long. But Germany has risen again. My dad understood then that it was not then. It was still future. I think he always believed that it would happen during his lifetime. And probably just like the Apostle Paul, who believed the same thing. My father probably didn't change his mind until he knew that death was near. And he thought maybe it would all come together and Christ would return while he was alive. Now here I am, standing here, telling you, I think the same thing. I think it's going to happen in our lifetime. I think it is near, even at the very doors. And I know that we have a collective work to do. I know that we need to give out a witness and a warning, and I know that we're going to stick to that, and we're going to preach it and teach it. I know that it's real. I know what I see in my news broadcasts are exactly the same thing you see, and I believe that you know exactly what the biblical prophecies say about it, and that you're aware, and that you're watching, and that you're praying, and I think that to you, we can ask God, please forgive us, but some of the most important things to us are our dearest loved ones, our children and our grandchildren, that we don't want to have to suffer physically. He says, with your eyes shall you see the destruction of the wicked, and the thousands shall fall at one hand and 10,000 at your other hand, but no plague shall come nigh thy dwelling. And he says, watch and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass. And I certainly do cling to that promise, because for our family and for your families, I know we want to escape all these things that shall come to pass. Well, brethren, I wish I didn't have to quit. I've got a lot of things I wish I could share with you. I wish I could stand up here and preach all kinds of sermons about everything from child rearing to diet, but we just don't have a chance to do that during the Feast of Tabernacles. It's been wonderful to be with you. I guess we've met so many of you here, just about all of you in this room, and it has been absolutely delightful. We're going to be sad going down the road, but we have it to do a little later on this afternoon. We'll be here for a while and be able to have lunch and then go on and get on an airplane. We will appreciate your prayers. Thank you so very much. Thank you for the love and the support. Thank you for your forgiveness and for your prayers on our behalf and for God's work. God bless you all. I hope you continue to have a wonderful feast. I know you've had some great spiritual feasts as well as good food. Had a wonderful time together. We love you all. God bless you.